Okay, so we will move on to our last presentation. Our last paper this afternoon was written by Edward Berger, and it will be presented by Vincent Pilote. Let me just say a couple of quick words about Ed. After 35 years at the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers, Ed retired in 2011 to spend more time on freelance writing and photography. He has since returned to IJS on a part-time basis as special projects consultant. Ed enjoyed a close association with jazz great Benny Carter, serving as his road manager and record producer in the 1980s and 1990s. He regularly teaches a course in discography at on jazz at Lincoln Center, and his latest book, a biography of trumpeter Joe Wilder, was published last month by Temple University Press. So this paper is on the recording career of Joe Wilder, but I'm sorry to say that at age 92, Mr. Wilder passed away last Friday. Is the funeral today?
It's today, yes.
The funeral is today. And so Ed was very, very close with Mr. Wilder and the family. And so he's working with the family now to plan the service. And also there's going to be a public memorial, which will be held in June. So for this reason, Ed's longtime colleague, Vincent Pilote, is going to give the paper today. I think Vince doesn't really need an introduction, but I will say a few words about him. He is currently interim director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University, Newark campus. He served as president of ARSC from 2009 to 2013. He has compiled discographies on Billie Holiday, Lionel Hampton, and the Commodore record label, and he is one of the contributors to the Oxford Companion to Jazz, Oxford University Press 2000, and I know that's one resource students at my college use a lot. So I give you Vinny, and he's going to be presenting From Jazz to Classical and Beyond, the Recording Career of Joe Wilder.
Thank you. I brought a copy of the book with me. I'm going to leave it up front here in case you want to come and look at it after. I'll just leave it on the table there. Well, one good thing about doing a talk for somebody else is if you don't like it, you can blame him. It's not my talk. So I have no pressure whatsoever. Yes, it's true. I agreed to do this, to deliver this talk for Ed. But I also knew Joe Wilder personally and met him many, many times. Very nice man. He used to always ask me about my brother, which I thought was very funny. Met my brother one time, and he just kept asking me about him every time I met him. But anyway, as Ed and I got to know Joe as a person, especially Ed, who spent many hours with Joe while researching the book, we both came to realize that the sensitivity, warmth, intelligence, and honesty, and even humor in his music was an extension of the man himself, because he has all of these personal qualities in abundance. It was his sterling personal qualities as well as his musical abilities that enabled him to overcome the barriers he faced that Ed tried to document in the book. As he mentions in the book's introduction, out of the scores of colleagues, friends, writers that he interviewed, the most negative comment Ed could elicit from anyone came from Joe's good friend, pianist Dick Hyman, who said he always dressed a bit more formally than he needed to. Here he is in the kitchen making cookies, but he's got a jacket and a tie on, okay? This is what Joe did all the time. Ed also wanted me to point out that the book, he did not intend for race to become the major focus of the book, but it became clear that at every point in Joe's career, it was a focal point, hence the subtitle of the book, The Breaking of Barriers in American Music. As Ed learned about what Joe and his fellow African Americans faced, both as musicians and human beings, and I'm pretty sure he didn't tell Ed everything, the fact that he emerged without bitterness, without hatred, and with his compassion and humor intact made both Ed and me admire him even more. Let's hear some music, since we're here to do that. This will give you a sense of what sets Joe Wilder apart as a trumpet player. Although, as we'll hear, Joe can play in a variety of styles, which is what enabled him to break some of the musical and social barriers alluded to by the book's title, his distinctive and beautiful tone and lyrical approach to improvising has always set him apart. This aspect is best displayed by his work and on ballads. So here's a sample from his 1959 album on Columbia, aptly called The Pretty Sound. The tune is Harbor Lights. It was a big hit for Sammy Kaye in 1950 and for the Platters a decade later. Joe Wilder was born in Colwyn, Pennsylvania, just south of Philadelphia, on February 22, 1922. Colwyn was predominantly white community, but the Wilder family lived in a row house on Front Street. It was one of three or four houses occupied by black families right next to the tracks of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. In 2011, Ed made a visit with Joe to Philadelphia, retracing all the places where he grew up, his schools, the sites of some of the theaters and clubs that he used to play in, and it was a very moving experience for both Joe and Ed. Here's Joe in the same neighborhood almost 85 years earlier, around 1927, I guess he's the kid in the middle, with his older brother Curtis Jr. and some neighborhood friends. As you can see early on, Joe had a very diverse upbringing. A similar experience to that of Philadelphia contemporaries like Buddy DeFranco and Jimmy Heath, whom Ed also interviewed for the book. Major influence on Joe was his father, Curtis, who was a serious musician who began on cornet before switching to tuba and later string bass. He eventually earned his living as a band leader after World War II, but while Joe was growing up, Curtis drove a truck and played music on the side. Curtis also had the distinction of serving in the Navy in both World War I and World War II. Here he is in uniform during World War I. Joe's mother, Augustine, but known as Gussie, was a very gregarious person and a mainstay of her church and community. Here's a picture of Gussie Wilder with her sons and grandsons, circa 1945. Joe's early musical training starts when he was 7 or 8 years old. His father came home and presented Joe with a cornet he had bought in the pawn shop. Joe began taking lessons with a trumpet player in one of the bands his father played in, but soon began studying with the noted African-American cornet player, Frederick Griffin. Griffin was heard regularly on radio in Philadelphia. That's interesting. Where did that come from? Let me back that up a little bit. Boing, boing, boing. That's where I want to go. These are students of Frederick Griffin. Joe made rapid progress at the age of 10, received his first press notice. That's this one. A small feature in the Philadelphia Tribune, which was an African-American weekly. The article mentions something called a Parisians, Tailors, Colored Kitties of the Air radio show on which Joe appeared from the age of 10 till about the age of 16. It was a huge hit, broadcast from Lincoln Theater in Philadelphia, often before a live audience of 2,000. The most remarkable thing about it was that as part of their contracts with the theater, the bands played there were obliged to back the youngsters during the Sunday morning broadcast. So Wilder got to meet and play with many of the major black bands of the swing era, including Ellington, Calloway, Basie, Lunsford, Henderson, Earl Hines, and many more. And because he was one of the few kiddies who played an instrument, most were singers, dancers, and even comedians, the musicians took a special interest in him. One of the most memorable encounters came in 1938 when Louis Armstrong appeared at the Lincoln Theater and heard Joe at the age of 16 play. This led to a lifetime friendship. Now, at that time, Joe was not playing jazz, really. He was not improvising. He was reading the melody parts of popular songs of the day, as well as playing some of the cornet concert pieces he was studying with Frederick Griffin. He admits to being more impressed with Del Stigers and Herbert Clark than Louis Armstrong, even though he was nicknamed Little Louie. Improvisation and jazz would come later. In 1929, his youngest brother, Edward, inadvertently started a fire in their house when he turned over a kerosene lamp. Joe's mother was hanging clothes in the yard and was able to run in and save Joe's two younger brothers, but the house and those adjoining it burned down. No one was injured. They moved out of Colwyn, just across the line to South Philadelphia, renting a house at 2018 South 70th Street, an integrated working-class neighborhood. And there's Joe in the neighborhood. Okay, he met this woman there when he went back who knew him, who knew the family. She was still living there, all right? He continued to develop musically at William Tilden Junior High School, playing in the school orchestra, and at the renowned Massbaum School of Germantown, which was famous for its music program. When he started there, as in many music schools at the time, the training was entirely classical, and jazz was not even permitted to be played on the premises, even though among his classmates were future jazz luminaries Buddy DeFranco and Red Rodney. During his freshman year at Massbaum, Joe's parents divorced, putting additional strain on the family's finances. Because of his ability to sight-read music honed at Massbaum, Joe was in great demand by some of the many local jazz and dance bands in Philadelphia. It was in these groups as well that Joe began to start to move in the direction of a jazz improviser. Until this point, he had been classically trained. This also began to dawn on him a symphonic career was almost impossible for an African-American musician in the late 1930s, since no major classical orchestra was integrated at that time. Kind of an apprentice period for him, while he was already an accomplished musician and an excellent reader, he was now becoming a jazz soloist. No recordings of him at this time, but from the descriptions of a few people Ed was able to interview who heard him then, especially musicians Shep Shepherd and Buddy DeFranco, they described Joe as a quick learner. Both pointed out that he was able to draw on classical technique and motifs in his improvisations, which gave his jazz playing a distinctive quality that remained throughout his career. This is Joe in 1940 with Lonnie Slappy's orchestra. In 1941, at the age of 19, Joe got an offer to join a name band with a national reputation, Les Heights Orchestra, beginning a big band odyssey that would last a decade into early 1950. In 1942, Joe moved on to Lionel Hampton's orchestra, which was a tremendous step up musically. Although Joe had recorded a brief melody solo with Les Height in 1942, we get our first example of him as a jazz soloist in a Hampton AFRS radio broadcast done soon after Wilder joined. Let's listen to something called The Great Lie from 1942. As you can hear there, his playing was very accomplished technically, but as an improvisation, you could kind of say it was rather formulaic and based on patterns. I would have been happy to play like that, really. What can I say? this would soon change as Joe became more confident as an improviser and developed his own approach. In 1943, Wilder's career was interrupted by the draft. The Marine Corps had just begun accepting black recruits, and Joe became one of the first 1,000 black Marines. But opening the Marine Corps to African Americans was a very far cry from integrating it. A separate and definitely not equal new facility was built for them at Fort Montford Point, a remote area of the huge base that would become known as Camp Lejeune near Jacksonville, North Carolina. The idea was to keep the black Marines as isolated from the rest of the Corps as possible. While he was in the Marine Corps, Joe met with Louis Armstrong on the base at Montford Point. Armstrong appeared to entertain the troops, and when one of his trumpeters took sick, he asked Joe to sit in with the band for the evening. He remembered Joe from the days with the Colored Kitties radio show in Philadelphia. After being discharged, Joe Wilder rejoined Hampton briefly before moving on to the Jimmy Lunsford Band Orchestra, of which he had been a great admirer growing up. Lunsford Band had fallen on hard times, but the leader was in the process of rebuilding the orchestra, and when Wilder joined, he was on the rise. He also greatly admired Lunsford as a leader and as a person. Like Wilder, he was greatly concerned with the image of musicians in general and black musicians in particular. This is a tune that Lunsford did called Call the Police. That's the name of the tune. Let's listen to the first solo on this for Joe, and then you can fade it after that.
Calling all cars! Calling all cars! Call the police, hurry, hurry. Someone stole my gal from me. Call the police, hurry, hurry. Call the police, quick, quick, quick. Call the police, hurry, hurry. Someone stole my gal from me. She's a little bitty girl about 5 feet high. Look out, man, don't you lie. She's not stout or plump or fat. Don't you worry, old man, she'll soon be back. Call the police, hurry, hurry. Call the police, quick, quick, quick. Call the police, hurry, hurry. Someone stole my gal from me. Mop it up. Mop it up. Mop it up.
Our Okay. Next stop after Lunsford was after Lunsford was with Dizzy Gillespie, 1947, which I thought I hit. There it is. Then after Gillespie was the band of Lucky Millinder, which Joe remembered as playing and as playing a fascinating mix of music commissioned from several top arrangers. One interesting fact about the band, the Millinder band, is that it was integrated, which in the late 40s was rare. But what was really extraordinary was that Millinder took his band on tour in the South. Joe had toured the South with Hampton and Lunsford, and in the book, there are many stories illustrating the problems faced by black musicians on the road, and not just in the South. But to take an integrated band down South in 1948 was almost unheard of. Although Joe made no studio recordings while a member of the Millinder band, although he did after leaving, an extraordinary radio air check exists of the band with Billie Holiday as a guest. The series was called Swing Time at the Savoy, and Billie Holiday, who had been impressed with Joe's playing behind her when she made a guest appearance the year before with Jimmy Lunsford's band, specifically requested that he back her for this version of her famous Billie's Blues. You can hear Joe's playing playing like fills behind her in a performance that is almost a duet.
Thank you, boys. That was beautiful.
That was very beautiful.
Indeed it was.
Do you know whom you're speaking to, Noble?
A lady.
But do you know who the lady is?
Let me take off my glasses.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Billie Holiday!
And where are you appearing this week, Billie?
At the Strand Theater on Broadway, Blackie.
That's wonderful. Swing Time at the Savoy is happy to have you as our honored guest, Lady Day. Tell me, what mood are you in?
I'm in a blue mood, and the song I sing is Billie's Blues. I love my man, I'm alive, I say I don't. I love my man, I'm alive, I say I know. But I'm with my man, I'm alive, I say I won't. I've been your slave, baby, ever since I've been your baby. I've been your slave ever since I've been your babe. But before I'll be your dog, I'll see you in your grave.
Okay. In 1948 and 1949, Joe played with two bands in which he was the only black musician. Did I do that wrong? Back it up. The bands of Sam Donahue and Herbie Fields. Again, there are many stories of what Joe had to put up with on the road in these situations, but he always stressed the fact that his fellow band members supported him completely, and in many cases, these young white musicians were more traumatized and embarrassed by the way Joe was treated than Joe himself, since he'd been dealing with these problems for years, and they were witnessing it for the first time. Despite this, there were some humorous aspects. I don't see that photo here. Okay, I don't know what Ed did, but anyway, you blame him, not me. I'm going to go on. there was a photo of Joe and fellow band members. Yeah, there it is. Is that it? Yeah, that's it. That's the photo. that's Joe and fellow band members at Herbie Fields Group outside the Silhouette Club in Chicago in 49. The policeman is warning them against disturbing the peace with bebop. That's why he's standing there, okay? It's posed. They're just fooling around. All right. Also in the book, let's see. I'm going to try to do some editing on the fly here, which is very hard when, again, you didn't write the thing. Okay, there was an accident of some kind somewhere in Ohio. Okay, because the Fields Band was a smaller group, they usually traveled in private cars. After leaving Chicago for New York, Joe was in the backseat of a car driven by trombonist Frank Rossellino. Bassist Max Bennett was riding next to Rossellino. Somewhere in Ohio, Rossellino dozed off. The car left the road, landed on a field, flipped over, crushing the roof before righting itself. Rossellino was unconscious, and Wilder and Bennett managed to get out of the car. Miraculously, none of the three turned out to be seriously injured, and they continued on to New York by bus. At this point, Wilder decided to give up the peripatetic life on the road. I love it. And decided to settle in New York. The means by which he was able to do this was to join an orchestra led by the venerable Noble Sissel in the Diamond Horseshoe Club in the Paramount Hotel. But musically, Joe paid a steep price because the shows at the Diamond Horseshoe, produced by impresario Billy Rose, were throwbacks to the age of minstrelsy in vaudeville, with the musicians wearing circus costumes and having to march around the club. When Wilder joined the stage show was called Banjo on My Knee. But by staying in New York, Joe was able to accomplish two things. He went back to school, earned his BA at Manhattan School of Music in 1953, and was able to break into the Broadway Show Orchestra. There's quite a bit in the book about his integrating the Broadway orchestras. Joe was one of the first, but not the first, black musician to play a non-black Broadway show. I believe the first was bassist Al Hall, who played in the orchestra of 1947 show Barefoot Boy with Cheek. Joe Wilder's first Broadway show came in 1950 when he played in the orchestra for Alive and Kicking. That was followed by a two-year stint in the original Guys and Dolls in 1955. He became the first African-American to hold down a principal chair in a Broadway orchestra when he was asked to play first trumpet on Silk Stockings. But before the producers could hire him, they had to run it by the show's composer, Cole Porter. When asked if he had any objections, Porter responded, "Can a man play my music?" When told that he could, Porter said, "That's all that matters," and Joe got the job. Guys and Dolls is one of the shows that Joe plays in the orchestra on, but let's pass that up for now. I mean, I don't think anyone's going to miss hearing Robert Alder sing. I'm not. Let's move on to Count Basie. All right. In 1953, Joe was offered a chair in the Count Basie Orchestra, although he swore he would never go on the road again. He and his first wife at the time were having problems, and he decided that going back on the road would give him some respite. By this time, conditions had improved, and musically he loved working with the Basie group. He didn't get a lot of solo space, especially on record, but he can be heard briefly on one recording that actually became the title of the book, Softly with Feeling. It was a Neil Hefti piece, and for those of you who might not know who Neil Hefti was, he was the composer of the Batman television theme song, and probably made more money doing that than all the years arranging for Count Basie. Joe plays the bridge on this thing, and as I said, he didn't get into a lot of solos, but what he does with these eight bars is absolutely beautiful. Let's just play that. Okay, that was Softly with Feeling. After leaving Basie's band in 1954, Wilder freelanced in New York, playing on Broadway shows and taking part in a wide range of recordings in the 1950s. Most significant was the first recording as a leader, an album called Wilder and Wilder on legendary Savoy label. Savoy is based in Newark, New Jersey, and was run by a notoriously cheap gentleman named Herman Lubinsky. Typically, the album was done in 1 3-hour session. One 3-hour session. And amazingly, Joe was not told he was the leader until after it was recorded, and he was asked to sign a contract. Despite the lack of Lubinsky did this all the time. And despite the lack of preparation, it turned out to be an excellent showcase for Wilder's talents as a jazz player, and showed that he had cast aside the formulaic, classically based approach that had developed a truly original solo style. He was aided by an ideal rhythm section of Hank Jones, Wendell Marshall, and Kenny Clarke. This is an excerpt of Cherokee by Joe Wilder's beautiful piece of improvisation. Let's excerpt the excerpt, even. I'm running out of time here. This next page is a feature on Joe Wilder accompanying vocalists. This is something he did very, very well. And you heard a sample of that with Billie Holiday. But let's just hear a couple of samples here. Let's go with the Ella Fitzgerald, Show Me the Way. But I Was Cool, Oscar Brown Jr.
His sentence there I see.
I played that because I also wanted you to hear his work with the mute. He was very good with mute, with the mute work, and he even showed Wynton Marsalis a few things, how to use that mute. So that was one of his specialties. Another thing Joe was known for was getting involved in the third stream movement. In the mid-1950s, composers like Gunther Schiller, J.J. Johnson, and John Lewis began experimenting with orchestral music that combined elements of jazz and classical, for which Shuler coined the term third stream. Joe Waller took part in a number of important sessions of this movement. His classical training and vast jazz experience, of course, ideally suited him for these efforts. But I'm going to pass up on planning any of those and move on. All right. As I mentioned, or as Joe mentioned, or maybe I mentioned too, Joe got a chance to do more classical playing in the 1960s and 1970s. I'm backing up here. Sorry. This is not easy. Okay. This is something that happened that Ed discovered. Joe was a witness in a fascinating case in which two musicians charged the New York Philharmonic and Leonard Bernstein, no less, with discrimination when they were rejected after auditioning. After protracted and highly contentious hearings in 1969, the Human Rights Commission delivered a mixed verdict. One of the musicians was the well-known bassist Arthur Davis, who was a leading jazz player as well. Davis, who died in 2007, was very outspoken and an activist who frequently commented on the case in interviews. The other plaintiff was a young classical cellist named Earl Madison, who was 23 at the time of the hearings and hadn't spoken about it publicly in the ensuing 43 years. He eventually agreed to provide for the first time for publication his perspective on what had taken place some four decades ago. Getting to know Earl Madison and hearing his story was one of the most rewarding aspects of working on the book, according to Ed Berger. Let me move on here. As I mentioned, Joe got a chance to do more classical playing in the 1960s and 70s, some through his work on staff at ABC, and much of it through his association with an orchestra called the Symphony of the New World. It was founded in 1964 by conductor Benjamin Steinberg with the express purpose of creating opportunities for African-American classical musicians. And there's a picture of that. In 1964, Joe got his only opportunity to make a classical recording. It came about because of his friendship with the great composer Alec Wilder, no relation, who wrote a piece specifically to feature his namesake. Alec had become infatuated with Joe's sound and used him on many projects. So in 1964, Alec wrote Sonata for Trumpet and Piano and arranged for Joe to record it along with some other classical pieces for his choosing, for Golden Crest Records, a small Long Island-based company. Here is a sample of his playing from that album. Because the Alec Wilder Sonata is rather long, I'll play a shorter piece, Allegro, by Joseph Hector Fiocco. He could handle it. He definitely could play the music, but he knew he wasn't ever really going to get a proper opportunity to really do that. But it was good that he did get a chance to at least make that one record. Here's just a sample of different things that Joe appears on, just to show the sheer variety of the kind of things that studio musicians have to do. Of course, my favorite one is the Hava Nagila with a group from Israel called the Four Ayalons that Joe was playing trumpet on. Could you just give me a little sample of that? It's really very interesting. They became lifelong friends after this session. They loved him, and he loved them. right there, Hava Nagila. The four Ayalons. Ayalons, yeah.
Nagila Hava, Nagila Hava. Nagila penis necha, nagila, 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 nagila penis necha. Ha ha, 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 ha ha,
Okay. There you go. Rather than retiring or resting on his laurels, the past two decades saw Joe Wilder strike out in new directions. This period coincided with the flourishing of the jazz repertory movement, and Joe played with two of the leading repertory ensembles, the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra and the Smithsonian Jazz Masterwork Orchestra. Usually the oldest member of these groups, he found himself in the singular position of recreating historic arrangements that he had first played 50 years ago when they were new. With the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra, which he joined for their first major tour in 1992, he and Wynton Marsalis became very close and formed something of a mutual admiration society, which continues, well, to this day. In February, Wynton hosted a 92nd birthday party for Joe at Dizzy's Club at Lincoln Center. And, of course, he wrote the foreword to the book. Perhaps even more significant, Joe devoted the past decade or so of his professional life to teaching. He joined the faculty at Juilliard in 2002 at the age of 80, when most faculty had gone to emeritus status and taught for a decade. He always remembered the musicians and teachers who helped him along the way, and this was his opportunity to give back. The rest of this is really just a photo montage, which I guess I'll skip because of time. He was a photographer, and these are just some of the photos that of different musicians and people that he met along the way. He was really an excellent photographer. I mean, you could do a whole book on just the photography that he did over the years. This is just some of the things. So if you want to know any more about the book or whatever, I'll be here. And thank you very much for listening. And Ed thanks you also.
Well, thank you, Vinny. You know, I can't help but think that Joe Wilder's family would be very proud and very happy that this presentation is being given today. So Tom is still here, Greg, Joe, Vinny. So we're going to formally close the session, but if any of you want to come up and talk or ask some questions, please do.